Patricia, and I'm a very, very, very grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon. And I want to thank Milton for calling me and asking me to speak. I was very surprised and very humbled when he called me and asked me to speak. Better? Okay. Okay, because of meetings and sponsorship and the three legacies of this program, my life is manageable and it's worth living today. Before I got into the program, life was not worth living. And you notice I said my life is manageable today, and it's manageable because I'm not trying to manage your lives. Because that's what my disease tells me to do, is try to manage other people's lives. I don't do that today. My home group is the Al-Anon Spoken Here group in Nashville, Tennessee. We meet on Saturday mornings at 10 o'clock, and our meeting lasts for an hour and 15 minutes. And we study out of the path to recovery. We do a step, a tradition, and a concept. My program consists of three legacies. Once I got a hold of the steps and seen what they did for my life, I grabbed hold of the traditions and the concepts and have really grown from all three legacies. I have a sponsor, and my sponsor has a sponsor, and I sponsor several women in the Al-Anon program. Before I get started with my story, I would like to take just a moment before I get started. So if you could have a moment of silence. Okay. I'm from Nashville, Tennessee, and I was raised in Nashville, Tennessee. I have four siblings. I have three brothers, and I'm the only girl. And I'm the second born. And so I have a brother that's older than me and two younger. And first part of my story is always the hardest. I grew up in the disease of alcoholism. In my family, growing up in the disease, there was things that would happen on the weekend when my mom and dad began to drink. There was things that happened. My mother's role and my role changed, and I became my brother's caretaker. And I became their mother instead of their sister, and I became the caretaker of my mother. And my father, he became the man that you feared. And growing up in my family, I came from a very violent background. Growing up on the weekends, there was lots of violence, but there was no violence during the week. So I spent a lot of my week, I started caretaking for my mother, I remember back as far as I was four, trying to make sure that that she didn't get beat every weekend. So on the weekend, the role reversal would start to change, and I was just sharing with someone about my mother's hair. She was a very, very, very bright redhead, and she had really curly hair. And when my mother would drink as a child, I would be over here doing something, but I would keep an eye on her hair from the back of her, and it would start to get fluffier as she drank, and fluffier and fluffier. And my mother's name was Billy, and she looked like a wild Billy, you know. That hair just got really fluffy. And so when I would see her hair starting to fluff out, I would stop what I was doing over here and come and stand beside my mother. And when my mother would get up to go to the bathroom, I would go to the bathroom with her. When she would come back, I would come back. I was like her shadow. But in the meantime, keeping a look over here out for my brothers and what they were doing, especially that youngest one. When the parties was over, you know, I was always that kid that's always in the background praying for the police to come. And then when the police would come, I would feel ashamed because I prayed for the police to come. But you know, the police would come to my house and they would pull up when all the violence would get started, and you would hear my mother say, "Well, hello, cuz." And it would be one of her cousins that got sent out to our place, and he was a police officer, and he would wind up just drinking with them. So I become very angry at God because I kept praying for all these things, and it just kept getting worse. When the parties would be over, my sole focus was on trying to make sure that my mother didn't get a beating on a weekend. I didn't know then that that wasn't my responsibility, but as a child, I took that on. So my mother, my father would start to beat my mother, and out of all of us kids, my mother would start screaming my name at the top of her lungs to please help her. And I tried that one or two times, when she would scream for me. And my dad, when I would go over and try to do something, he would knock me across the room. And so I felt helpless, hopeless, and I couldn't help her. So I would go in the bathroom, and I would turn on all the water faucets, and I would put my hands over my ears, and I would keep repeating over and over and over again how much I hated my father. I remember just going, "I hate you, I hate you," and I would just do it over and over and over and over again, and I felt this adrenaline, and I didn't want to hear what was going on in the other rooms because I could hear the sounds of my mother being hit and her screaming my name, and I was trying to drown that out. But even though you try to drown that out, you still feel the floor. You can still feel the floor. And I could still feel that it was going on from the thumps on the floor. And so after it was over, I would hear a knock on the bathroom door. And I'd open the bathroom door, and my mother's face would be bloodied, and her nose would be broke. And and her eyes would be swollen, and they were always black by the next morning. So I would set her down on the commode, and I would get rags, and I would bathe her face and clean the blood off of her, and tell her how sorry I was that I wasn't able to help her. And she would cry, and she'd say, "Why didn't you come?" And I tried, but I couldn't. I know today, if there had been a gun in the house, I would have probably shot my father in the back. But there wasn't one, and I'm grateful there wasn't a gun in the house, because I would have killed him. The next day, we would get up, and You didn't see what you saw, and you didn't hear what you heard, and you didn't talk about those black eyes, and you didn't talk about the broke nose, and you didn't talk about the bruises. You just went on and you played, and you act like you didn't see it. I made a mistake once by saying to my aunt and my grandmother, something about my mother's black eyes. And my father, he would take off his belt and he would whip me for telling the secrets. And he would tell me to go back out there and you tell those people, you tell them that you lied. So I'd go back out and I'd tell them that I lied and I'm sorry that I lied. This is where I started doubting my reality. Because you didn't see what you saw and you were not allowed to talk about it. My mother would go to work the next week with her bruises and I would set out. This is where I learned how to start to try to make up for somebody else's stuff. And I became the very best housekeeper at 4 and 5 years old because I knew that if I shine the furniture and I clean the woodwork and I cleaned and I cleaned and I cleaned and Mama would come home, if she would smile, then maybe I could take away and make up for not being able to help her. So this was our ongoing thing. Every weekend, she would get beat and I would clean frantically trying to make her smile, trying to make up for something. Of not being able to help her. But we still never talked about it. We just did it. She would smile, and I would get this little bitty thing that I made Mama smile, so maybe, just maybe. Just maybe. There were times, we lived in a house where there were stairs, and I used to sleep on the stairs. I slept on the lower part of the stairs until the parties were about over as I got older. Because I knew my mother would come for the stairs after the party was over, and I was scared she would fall back down the stairs. But sometimes the fights would get started, and I would be stuck upstairs instead of being able to go to the bathroom and be there for her when it was over. And I remember going one night, they were fighting, and I went, the middle brother, my brothers would sleep through this, and I would shake my brother, and I would say, Daddy's beating Mama again, set up and be with me. I need him to set up and be with me. And he says to me, shut up and leave me alone, I'm sleeping. And we're little kids, but something snapped in me because he wouldn't get up and he wouldn't sit with me and be with me. And I didn't have anybody. So I jumped on top of him and I started beating him the same way my dad was downstairs beating my mother. I just wanted him to be with me so I wouldn't be so alone. So Daddy's fighting Mom and I'm fighting my brother. And it's insane. And it's crazy. And it's insane. And I would pray, and I didn't do good. I did not do good in school because I spent my whole week trying to figure out. Somebody would tell me, if you could fix some grilled cheeses and just really put butter on it and get your mom to eat that before she starts drinking, she won't get drunk. I found out that's a lie. That don't work. That does not work. So as I'm getting older, there was a night that my dad, he had passed out and he woke up and I was probably around 10 and he grabbed me by the hair of the head and he lifted me up off of the floor and I could feel my hair snapping loose from my scalp and I thought, oh God, he thinks I'm Mama. and I knew what was coming. And out of my mouth came, "Daddy, it's me, it's me." And he came to his senses and he dropped me, but he went straight to my mother. And so I took all that in and I kept stuffing it. Every fight, I loved my daddy during the week and I hated his guts on the weekend. And as I got older, I'd been stuffing all this stuff, all the anger, all the anger, all the anger. And me and that one brother, we fought a lot. And that younger brother of mine, he was real little, and I was really mixed up because I really felt like I was his mother instead of his sister. And I was really close to that younger brother of mine. And he was in diapers, so I learned how to change diapers at a very, very, very early age. And I'm going to say this because I've never really said it, telling my story before, because I think it's really important. My nerves were so bad that I would wet the bed at night as a child. And you got a whipping with a belt when you did that at my house. So I prepared for the whipping the first thing in the morning. I have heard since, I used to be so ashamed of that, and there were times so they could punish me for doing that, they would stick a diaper on me and a pair of rubber pants in front of all the people that they were partying with. And it was very humiliating and embarrassing. But I guess in their mind, they thought that that would stop me from wetting the bed. But it didn't. I just started staying awake all night, so I wouldn't wet the bed when I could. So anyway, as I'm getting older, I start to mature, and let me go back. My mother, when there was times that she would take off for a weekend when my dad was at work and she wouldn't come home, and she would leave us kids, and she would forget where she left us at. And so I learned how to, she left us with these people, and while leaving us with these people, I was sexually abused. I was sexually abused 3 times growing up, because that's part of the disease of alcoholism, is violence, sexual abuse, and prison, and all of those things. And so as one of my mother's sister's husband sexually abused me growing up, and later I found out, and I'll get to that part in my story, that my parents actually knew that he was a sexual predator, but they left me and my brothers with him, and they went out dancing. Now, when I got just a little bit older and I found this out, and I thought, my God, they really loved that alcohol better than they loved us to leave us with that man. You know, how could they leave us with him, knowing? And but as I got older, I would walked one day down to the Five and Dime store. It's when the song by the Archies came out, Sugar Sugar. Really liked that song. And I earned money from babysitting my brothers. So I would go down to get that record, that little 45. And on the way down there, there was this boy, and he was sitting on one of those horses where you drop the quarter in. And he was sitting on the horse, and all these girls were all around him, you know. And I heard somebody say, "Hey, girl, what's your name?" And I turned around and looked, and I thought, he's talking to me. And he got down, and he left those girls that were surrounding him there, and He started walking with me, and all of a sudden, you know, somebody noticed me. And all of a sudden, I wasn't in my head trying to figure out what that weekend was going to look like. Because I had attention from this young boy, and it felt good. And I started realizing that my focus was on this young man that started calling me. And my dad was a very strict person. He wouldn't let me go out with anybody, but my mother did talk him into letting the boy come and sit and watch TV with me and stuff like that. So as life got crazier at my house and the guns was going off in my house and it got crazier, this guy says to me, you know, if you would just marry me, I would get you out of this. And at that time, I was 12. And he said, I could get you out of this. And he said, we could get married and we could get a place and your brothers could come and stay with us. And that sounded really good. It sounded really good because he could see what was going on in my home. And his mother had left him and six boys on a mattress in a house and ran off with a man. And so he wanted out of his house too. So by the time I was 14, I said to my father, my mother, I kind of hinted around that about getting married, and ooh, that was a bad thing to bring up. My daddy got that belt out again. So this guy says to me, well, you know, if I know a way that your dad would let us get married, and I said, okay. And he says, if you were pregnant, he would let us get married. And I thought about it, and I thought about the weekends, and I thought about not living there and being over there and somewhere else and having my brothers with me and not having to take on that responsibility. And I said, okay. So I got pregnant with my first daughter at 14 years old. I had her at 14, and my daddy did let me get married because he did not believe in that, so it worked. But by the time I got to Harksville, Tennessee, to do the to get married, we were standing in front of the Justice of the Peace, and I seen my daddy cry for the first time when I walked out to go and get married. I watched him cry for the first time. And I thought, wow, he does love me. And my mother, she kept trying to talk me out of getting married. She said, you don't have to do this, but I seen the look in my father's eyes and I knew I did. By that time, I didn't want to get married anymore because I could see that Daddy really did love me. But my father was angry, and he told me to get out and don't come back until I was married. And there was a lot of other words with that I won't say. And so I stood before the Justice of the Peace, and I was crying. And my soon noon-to-be husband says, hold up. And he goes over next door, and he gets me some candy corn, my favorite candy. And he brings it to me to stop me from crying. And I'm standing there, and I'm eating candy corn, looking at the Justice of the Peace. And the Justice of the Peace looks at me, and he says, little girl, what are you going to do when your husband tells you that he's going hunting and you find his hound dogs tied to a tree? And I did not know what that meant. And I said, he don't hunt, sir. Oh, but I soon found out what he meant. I soon found out what he meant. So we got married, and we went back, and my daddy wasn't ready to let me come back in his house yet. And what I forgot and what I didn't realize is my new husband didn't have a job, and he didn't plan on working, so I don't know how we was going to get that house I was supposed to be living in away from my parents. So we lived with his parents for about 3 weeks.
His mom married that guy, and so we lived with his mom and his stepdad for 3 weeks, and my daddy got to missing me and had my mother call me. My dad never told me he loved me. We just always, my mother was the messenger. Your daddy wants you to come home. But daddy was never going to tell me that. And she'd always say, you know, your daddy loves y'all, but daddy never told us that. And so we got to move in with my father, and then it was really crazy, because then I had the baby, and the baby was upstairs, so I'm torn between my baby, and I'm torn between my mother and her coming up the stairs, because now she wants to get drunk and come up the stairs all the time. So I'm running up and down the stairs, I'm sleeping on the steps with my baby, and then it just kept getting crazier, and it just kept getting crazier. And my mother come up the stairs one night, and I was so tired I fell asleep too far up the steps, and she flipped backwards and busted her head on the wall, and blood was all over the floor, and I thought she was dead, but it knocked her out, and I was screaming, let's get her to the hospital, but my dad wasn't having that. We wasn't going to any hospital because she's drunk and we're not taking her to the hospital, so we didn't. So I laid awake that night wondering if my mother was going to bleed to death and if she'd be dead by the next morning when I woke up. But she wasn't, but it was a mess, and she really did need stitches. My dad got my husband a job, and we eventually moved out of the house and moved in our own house. And, we moved in our house, and then it's not until I came into Al-Anon I really see what happened. All that stuff I'd been shoving and stuffing down since I was little, all the fights that I couldn't stop, and then he's got this resentment about his mother. And I forgot to say, and I needed to say this earlier, is my mother told me long time ago, Tricia, a man doesn't love you unless he's jealous of you. So I was confused. I thought they had to be jealous or they didn't love you, because that's why my mama got a beating every weekend. And so when I picked this guy out, I picked my daddy out when I married him. So when we got in the house by ourselves, he started acting like my father did with my mother. And I was really angry at my daddy for that. And I remember being on the phone one day talking to one of my friends, and he came in, and he took the phone, and he snatched it off the wall, and he threw it on the floor. And that's the very thing my father used to do. And I snapped, and that's before the cordless phones. And I took that phone cord, and as he was walking away, I slung it around his neck, and I tightened it really hard, and somewhere I got strength that I never knew I had, and I yanked him back up into me from behind, and the anger was just coming out in me. You know, I had this flashback of my father and my mother and what he would do to her, and I yanked him back to me, and I said, is my father your idol? Because he's not mine. Don't you ever do that to me again. And I was pulling it as tight as I could, and he was trying to get it off, and I was, you know, it's hard to get that out when it's all curly and stuff, and I didn't care how he got it off. And he come home from work today one day, and I was sitting there with a friend, and I fixed this big pot of chili for supper, and I had a cousin that was taking sewing classes, so she made me this blouse. Well, he came in, and immediately he didn't like the top I was wearing, so he backhanded me, and I didn't see it coming. And when he backhanded me, I looked straight across the room at the pot of chili on the stove. I went for the chili, and he went for the door. There There was no alcoholism in our home, but I was acting just as crazy as my father and mother did. And what I realized after I came into Al-Anon, the very thing I despised in my father, I became. I hated him, I pointed my finger at him, but I was my father. I had turned into my father. And so I chased him down the street trying to scald him with a pot of chili. And I got angry because I couldn't get close enough, so I just took the skewer and slid it, knocked his feet out from under him. I was so angry that he would hit me like that. You know, I would think, I'm not my mother, I'm not my mother, and I'm not going to be my mother. And so we would get in these things. And what I realized today is I brought a big luggage into our marriage, and it was packed with anger, violence. But mainly, it was packed with a lot of stuff and resentment. And he came in, and he brought his baggage, too. So we both had a baggage, and we opened it up. When we opened that baggage up, we became our parents. And there was no hope for that marriage because he hadn't dealt with his mother stuff, and I sure hadn't dealt with my father stuff. So we was really dangerous in this relationship together. Really dangerous. And I remember a night I came in, and I found he had been cheating on me. And it was Christmas time, and I always got these real huge Christmas trees. And so without even looking to see where my children were by then, I had two kids. I had two daughters. And my eight-month-old was sitting over in on the floor. And without even looking to see where she was, I backhanded the tree, and I was trying to knock it over on him. And I said, "You've ruined our Christmas, you know." I said, "You've ruined our Christmas." And that tree barely did miss my daughter's face, and all those little glass bowls on there, they all busted, and it barely did miss her eyes, and I realized then how crazy it was, how insane I had become. In the meantime, my brothers had grown up, and I remember sitting at the top of the stairs with those boys telling them, when we grow up, we're not going to be like them. We're not going to drink, and we're not going to be like them. But those bubbas of mine, all three of them grew up, and they became alcoholics and addicts. And so I used to think, "Mama, if they got to be jealous to love you, you ought to come over here and see the one I got, you know? If this is love, I don't like it, and I don't want it, and I don't need it." So I left him, and I had nowhere to go. I could have went back home to my parents, but I wasn't going back into that. So I put my daughter on my hip, and I had my other daughter by the hand, and we took out walking with nowhere to go. I didn't know what I was going to do, but every step I took, I felt free. I felt free. And then I turn around, and he was coming down the street behind me, and he was telling me to get back in the car, and I just thought, I don't have to do that anymore. I'm free. I'm free, and I don't have to do this anymore. And I just kept walking, and I just kept walking. This is where I get to say, you know you're an Al-Anon when. When he left to go to work the next day, I snuck back to the house to get that extra car we had that he wouldn't let me take. And I snuck back to get it, and while I was there, I thought, you know, because I'm a caretaker, and I started feeling sorry for him because he was crying. And I thought, he took my keys from me, my house keys. So I went back to the house, and I climbed up on the roof, and I went through the back bathroom window. I grabbed a few things, and I turned around and looked at the house, and I thought, I got to clean it before I leave him. So I cleaned the house. God, it's insane today when I think about it. I cleaned the house, and I left him a note saying, I cleaned the house. I was sick. I was really sick. And so my daughters and I didn't have anywhere to go, and we slept in the car, and we was like homeless for the next 2 weeks. And we went to the park, and they thought they were car camping. And we would go to the park every day, and we would be at the park, and I had very little money because my husband used to take my money to make sure that I couldn't leave him. But then I started having the place that I was employed at put money in the credit union so I could get to it when it was time to leave him. But I didn't know I couldn't leave him on $300 a month, but I did. And so I would buy peanut butter, and I would buy Jell-O for their drink and mix it up and give it to them, and they just thought we were having the best time. And the whole time I was terrified and scared to death and didn't have anywhere to go. And so we slept in the car, and we slept in the car, and I would go to gas stations, and I would, they had little sun suits, so I'd go to the gas station, and I would take their little sun suits in there, and I'd wash them out on my hands in the sink. And then I would go to the park and lay them up on the hood of the car so they could dry while the kids were playing. And so we did this for 2 weeks, and I lost a lot of weight. And somebody noticed it where I was working, and somebody had told him that I was sleeping in the car. And so she asked me to move in with her and be her roommate, so I did. But I'm still hiding from him because it's not good to let him find me. Because he was really angry by now. His crying had turned into rage. And so, anyway. But in the meantime, you know, I have to start focusing somewhere else. My brothers by now are getting in trouble. One of them's going to prison. And the other one had a stroke, and he was intoxicated. And he had a stroke while he was intoxicated. Didn't realize he was having a stroke, and it left him blind in one eye. And they got him to the hospital before, you know, things got worse. And the other brother, the one that I used to fight all the time, he was in and out of prison, and he went to prison. He's done 35 years in prison. And now, in the meantime, I'm thinking that there's something that I could have done and should have done, because that's what my disease tells me. You should have been able to help your brother and keep him out of prison. You should have been able to keep your other brother from having that stroke. It was always you shoulda, and if onlys. I lived there all my life. I lived there. That's where I lived. I kept going. Started to go out, and it seemed, you know, I started to date other people, and the people that I dated, I was never attracted to the talkative man. I always liked the quiet man that sat over in the corner that was really, really, really quiet. And I always wondered, you know, what he was all about. And every time I got one of them, it wound up being my father again. So, and, you know, my brothers, when they were out there running crazy and stuff, I would go and I would get me, I would stop and pick up applications. And I would fill out the applications for my brothers, and I would turn them in. And that's when you didn't have to do it online. And so I became their employment agency to get them jobs that, you know, that they never applied for. And then I would get my younger brother those roofing jobs because he is a good roofer. And then I would get him the job, and I'd be scared that the people would give him money to drink on and that he wouldn't come back. So I got out there, and I started climbing up on those rooftops with him and helping him roof those houses to make sure that he finished the job before he got a drink. I was really crazy. I was really crazy, and my life was really unmanageable. And I didn't know how to stop doing what I was doing. And I would give my brother that was in prison, I would give him money, and I couldn't say no. I could never say no to him. At one point, what brought me into these rooms is that younger brother of mine, he called me and he was really sick. And I went over and I took him to the doctor on Monday. By Thursday, he was dead. When the doctor told him that it didn't look good, and they told us his diagnosis while I was sitting in the office with him. I did not know that this was a disease. I did not know that alcoholism was a disease. And so when they told me that he may die, I crossed the room with my fist and I started hitting my brother all over with my fist, asking him what he had done. I said, "What did you do? What have you done?" And he said, same words I heard our speaker say last night, "I just wanted to fit in somewhere, sis. I just wanted to fit in somewhere." I didn't have a program then, so, you know, I can't take that back. But as my brother got sicker and started getting chills and as he was dying, I covered him up. I climbed on top of him because his body was shaking so hard in the hospital. And I would climb on top of him and try to warm him up. And hopefully he knew I was there and that I loved him and that I was so sorry for being so ugly. But he passed away, and when he passed away, I had a breakdown. My therapist kept telling me, if you keep trying to manage all these people in your life, your mind's going to do for you what you won't do for your mind. And I thought, she didn't know what she's talking about. But one day I got up and I just couldn't function anymore, and I didn't want to get out of bed. So that was in October, and I really didn't come back around to myself until February. And my brother had passed away. The other brother had gotten out of prison briefly. And I had an expectation that he was going to fill the shoes of that dead brother. Okay, he's going to get out, and he's going to make me feel all better. But he didn't. He didn't. We still fought. And so about that time, my youngest daughter, she goes out and she gets her a job in a prison. And I thought, she's trying to drive me out of my mind. And she gets her a job in the prison, just as my brother goes back to prison. And then about that time, my husband, my daughter comes home and she says, "Mama, I'm in love." And he's an alcoholic and he's a crack addict, but "I'm in love, Mama." And I thought, oh God, here we go again. And about that time, my husband had a heart attack. And so all this was here. And I brought my husband home from the hospital, and they had given him some medication, some painkillers. And I was in so much pain. I just didn't really want to be here anymore. I really understood that speaker last night. And one night, I was in so much pain because I kept living in the if-onlys, if I had adjust, and I still couldn't get over my brother being dead. And so I took a handful of my husband's pain medication, hoping that I wouldn't wake up the next morning. But I woke up the next morning anyway. I didn't take enough. And I remembered my therapist telling me about Al-Anon. And at that time, I was so angry at the disease of alcoholism. I didn't know it was a disease, but I was so angry at the alcoholics, I wasn't about to give them another minute of my time. I thought I was going to go there and learn how to feel sorry for them. I didn't know it was about me. So it took me 10 years back when she had told me to go, and I refused to go. But when I woke up that morning, I thought, you know, I'm going to try that, and I'm going to see if it works. And if it doesn't work, I'm going to come back, and I'm going to finish what I started. So I called, and I found out where a meeting was, and I walked into my very first Al-Anon meeting. And when they read that opening, I knew I was where I belonged. It sent chills down me, and I couldn't stop crying, and they just, wow. I was right where I needed to be. And thank God in this program we have people that sign up to go and do a newcomers meeting. We're lacking in some of that at our meetings today, and it makes me sad. It just makes me so sad. So a lady, they said, is there a newcomer that would like a newcomers meeting? I raised my hand, and this beautiful young girl come across the room and led me to my newcomers meeting, and she opened up the understanding the family disease of alcoholism pamphlet. And she said, did you know that alcoholism is a disease? And I said, I didn't know. I was glad to hear it. Just give me a label. I needed a label, something to make me feel better. And she held it out in front of me, and I read it. She asked me to read it, and it says the medical association says that alcoholism is a disease, and that people were affected by the disease of alcoholism that lived in the alcoholism with the family. They were affected. I didn't know I was affected. But when she told me it was a disease, I could feel the weight being lifted from my shoulders. Right there in that moment, I could feel the weight being lifted off of my shoulders. Just knowing. See, I used to think they were doing it to me and at me. And now I knew they weren't. They just couldn't stop, you know. And it didn't mean that my mom and my dad or my brothers loved the alcohol better than me. It was an addiction. And today I know, because my alcoholics are addicted to the alcohol, and I'm addicted to them. And my addiction to them is just as strong as their addiction to that alcohol. Because, boy, I want to get in and I want to fix them and control them and manage them and manipulate them and mother them. And, wow, what a relief to know that I did not have to do that anymore. That lady that did my newcomers meeting, she became my sponsor. And I got started on the steps immediately. And in those steps, I remember sitting at her table, and I'm doing the first step. And as I'm doing the step, my youngest daughter calls, and she says, Mama, you're going to be angry at me, but I've lost another job. Well, I didn't know anything really a whole lot about step one. And when I got off the phone, my sponsor could see that my mood had changed. And she said, what's going on? I said, my daughter lost another job. She said, did you lose yours? And I said, no. And she says, do you have to go beat the path tomorrow to find a job? And I said, no. And she said, then let's get back to step one here. She said, let's get back to step one. She said, that's your daughter's job, not yours. And you know, I didn't know that either. I didn't know that I didn't have to go out and get my daughter a job. I didn't know I didn't have to do that, because my disease is an oversense of responsibility. I think I'm supposed to do these things. I think I'm supposed to do them, and I'm supposed to caretake, and I can't get a hold on that without this program. I did seven meetings a week, and I did that for the first 6 years of my program. I went every single day because I couldn't get enough. I couldn't get enough. I needed to hear more and more and more. And it was beautiful. It was beautiful. And when I got down to that third step, my sponsor said to me, she said, you look at me. She said, do you believe that I have a higher power? And she had a twinkle in her eyes, and she was so happy, and you could tell she was just living life. And I said, I do believe you have a higher power. And she says, well then, I'm going to loan you my higher power until you find one. So you act as if until you get there. And you know, that step sneaks up on you. It sneaks up on you. It really sneaks up on you. It's one of the things that I didn't tell you about this disease being an isolating disease. I didn't step foot in a restaurant until I was 26 years old, and I married the man that I'm married to now, because my mom and dad said we didn't belong in those kind of places. So my dad would get out and go in and order the food and bring it out. It would just be like hamburgers and stuff, but we never went inside a restaurant. So y'all were those people that I didn't fit in with, and I wasn't a part of you. So when I went in my very first restaurant, as a matter of fact, I almost didn't marry this guy because He after I met him, he kept calling me and asking me to go out, and I thought, he's going to want to take me to a restaurant, and I don't do restaurants, and I don't know what they do with all them forks. I mean, you got 3 or 4 forks to eat with there, and I didn't know what you did with all those forks and all them extra glasses you had, because we didn't do those things. And so the first time I went in a restaurant, I grabbed him by the back of his shirt, and my oldest daughter grabbed me by the back of mine, and the youngest daughter grabbed her, and we looked like the Duck family going in. And I'm going to tell you, I was hyperventilating, and everything he ordered, I said, me too, because I didn't know how to do that either. And I was so scared. I was so scared. And so if you knew who I was then and how scared I was of you, if you just knew, you would know what this is. This is a miracle that I can stand up here in front of you, because I was scared of you. I wasn't good enough. I was terrified of you. He eventually called me and asked me to go out, and I said, you know what, I'll go out, but I ain't hungry, but I'll go for a motorcycle ride. So I put that hungry stuff right off right then and there. So he come pick me up on a motorcycle, and we went for a motorcycle ride. My older brother got cancer, and so he come to go to the hospital with me, and he was dressed in a suit when he come to pick me up. Now, I like a jeans and t-shirt man, and because I feel more comfortable around him. I know that's what it is now, because I didn't belong around the men in the suits and stuff. That's not who I belonged around. I got that message growing up. So he comes to get me, and he's in a suit. And I said, well, you didn't have to dress in a suit to go see my brother in the hospital. And he says, I'm not. I'm coming from work. And I didn't realize we'd been dating for about a month, and I'd never even asked him where he worked. And so I said, you dress like that to go to work? So I could immediately feel that, you know, I'm drawing away in him, but I'm already hooked. See, I'm already crazy about him. So he stayed. But anyway, when I got to that third step, somebody came in the meeting one night, and she was really upset, and she says, what does a God of my understanding look like? What does it look like to turn my will over? And something took me over, and I was just speaking, and I said, you know, when you chair your first meeting, when you're so scared to death of people, when you chair my first meeting, when I share for the first time, when a sponsee comes in, when a woman comes in and says, will you sponsor me? And I say, yes, I will. And you can walk in those restaurants and the door be open and you walk in before them. And you walk past those fears. It was right then at that night I realized I had the God of my understanding, because I was doing all these things that so terrified me. And all these spiritual things was happening, but they were so slow. All of a sudden I realized I had moved into a place where it had to be God, because it sure wasn't me, because I'd kind of dropped my self-will when I got into those rooms. And so I told my sponsor, I said, I've got my own higher power now. Because what I was realizing, too, is when I came in, I had a getcha God, a punishing God. And what I realized was, after I did some writing and journaling, is I realized that I was looking through my grandmother's eyes at my higher power. My grandmother had a getcha God, and she let me know real quick what was going to happen if I got married the second time. And so I had already done give up on God, but Al-Anon lets me have a relationship with a God of my understanding. It's a relationship with my understanding of God. And I was so, so grateful for that. But you know, I've already handed that getcha God down to my girls. And so I'm trying to undo that today, and I'm trying to tell them I was wrong. I handed you a God that I got through my grandmother, and I'm trying to give them a different God today. through my own example of what that looks like. It hurts so bad when my daughter says, you know, God's going to punish me for this. And I'm thinking, those are my words. Those are my words, and those were the words of my mother and my grandmother to me. And so they're slowly learning. When I did my fourth step, and I sat down and I wrote all the things and everything down, and to have a woman that sat down with me and listened to me for 3 hours, we sat and we did my fourth step. And I thought, when she gets through listening to this, she's going to hate me. She's not going to treat me the same when she finds out everything I've done. And I told her when I got ready to leave, I said, now I'm going to be watching for you to change. I says, because you can't possibly love me after everything I've just told you. And she hugged me, and that's where I first learned unconditional love is from my sponsor. My love had always had conditions on it. That sixth and that seventh step that the speaker was talking about last night, I had to grin when she was talking about it, because when I got to that step, it was really messing with me. Those two steps really, really, really messed with me. And so I had a plan. I thought, I'm going to go down and I'm going to see my doctor, and I'm going to tell him that I've got attention deficit disorder. And he gave me this little test that you fill out, this little thing, and I filled out all the paperwork on it, and he said, yep, got attention deficit disorder. So he gave me a prescription, and I thought it was going to make me be able to. I thought, I'm going to show this six and seven. I'm going to really know how to do it now. But see, I was trying to control it. I wasn't letting God control it. And so I got it, and I waited, and I took the medicine. It was Statera, and I waited for the miracle to happen. You know, for instant, I get it, I'm doing it, and it didn't happen. And finally, I just kind of gave up. And what I realized today is that was surrender. When I surrendered into this step, and I laid it down, the step started working me. I wasn't in control of the step. God was in control of the step, and that's what I was forgetting, is I wasn't in control of the step. The step was in control of me, and so was God. So the step worked me, and I get it today. I know about that step today, and I'm grateful for that step today. And because of that step, those two steps, there's been a internal change with inside me, and I'm not the same woman I used to be. Three years ago, on Christmas Eve morning, my father called me at 4 o'clock in the morning, and he said, you better get over here. Your mama's not waking up. And so I get in the car, and I've worked this step enough to know. I've worked the steps, and I want to say this. My mother, until I accepted my mother for who she was and right where she was and quit judging her, she couldn't be open and honest with me. When it's like she felt the shift in me and the change when I finally got there where I was no longer judging her for her drinking. Because I used to say terrible things to my mother. I used to tell her, the next drink you put in your mouth, I hope I drop dead in front of you so you can see how bad it hurts me. And then she had a couple of miscarriages, and she said to me, they would have probably been girls. And I said, they would have just probably been two more alcoholics. And I would say mean, cruel things to her because I didn't know it was a disease. And I thought if I hurt her enough or if I said these things enough, that maybe, just maybe, she would stop drinking, but she didn't. But when I stopped judging, and this program changed my judging to loving. And I love my mother, and I let my mother be who she was, and I accepted her for who she was. and the judgment had been removed from me. My mother, I took her to the doctor one day, and she wanted me to pull in, and she wanted to pay for my lunch, but she wasn't going in. So we went through that drive-through window, and we sat in the parking lot, and she said, "You know, Tricia, I want you to know that I'm really sorry for the way I've raised you kids, and I know I've done a lot of bad stuff." And my mind went straight to, "Now, God, are you fixing to take my mother from me now that I've got this relationship with her?" And I thought, I'm going to let this, what I'm going to do here is what I'm about to do is let the disease, my disease, take from me this beautiful moment with my mother, and I'm going to go into fear and I'm going to miss it all. So I thought, I'm not going to focus on that. So my mom and I had the most wonderful, wonderful conversation that day. But 3 weeks later, that's when my dad called, and I went over there, and I watched my daddy have his, I went into the bedroom, and where my mother was, and she was laying on her side, and she had a fifth of whiskey in the bed, and she had a bottle of pills. My mother would drink, she'd forget she had already taken her medicine, she'd take some more, and you'd tell her, "You've already taken that." She'd say, "Don't tell me what to do," and so she would take her medicine again. So my mother had OD'd. She wasn't trying to, but she OD'd, and she was laying on her side, and I just looked at her. But you know the difference is? I wasn't angry at her like I was my brother. When I beat my brother in the chest, when I was so angry because I thought they were doing it to me, I just felt sad that my mother didn't find this program that y'all have and find the freedom that you've got, that I see that you have. And I love it when I come and I hear you speak and I see there's hope. And it could have been for her, but like your big book says, some of them won't make it. And she didn't. She'll never know what it's like to have a husband like I've got. But she did get to see it. And she said, "Now, Kenny, that's what you need to be like." And that was my dad's name. And my dad said, "He just needs to get her under control." Because he would bring me flowers and he would encourage me to be who I am, and I never had anybody like that before. And when I married this guy over here and we were walking down the aisle, and I thought, "Damn, I'm going to marry him." And then he's going to wait for us to get married, then he's going to show me that other side all the rest of the guys showed me. So my daddy wouldn't walk me down the aisle, so we walked each other down the aisle, my husband and I did. And as we're walking down the aisle, I was saying under my teeth, I was saying, "Is this really you?" And he said, "What you see is what you get." And he has been. He has been. He's been one of the most beautiful things that's ever happened to me, besides this program and my children and the spiritual awakenings I've had in these rooms. My mother died. We're at the funeral home. I'm sitting beside my daddy. My daddy's never touched me. My daddy's never hugged me. My daddy's never said he loved me. We're sitting at the funeral home, and I'm sitting there, and he's sitting beside me, and all of a sudden he put his hand on top of mine, and I looked at his hand, and I thought I wanted to run, because he's never touched me, so it didn't feel right. This program has taught me to sit there. He's reaching out. Sit. And so I started praying the serenity prayer to give me courage to leave my hand where it was at, because it did not feel right laying on top of my hand. And I thought, it does not feel good. It does not feel good. And then I thought to myself, "Damn you, don't you start getting mushy on me now. You've been a hard ass all these years. Don't you start getting mushy on me now, because I don't know what to do with mushy in him." But I left my hand there until it felt okay. It felt okay. And then I was able to put my hand on top of his. But I can't get over how terrible it felt. I'm sad to say this, but I'm happy to say it. My father's 74 years old, and I have the best relationship with my daddy today than I have ever had with my daddy. We've gotten really close.
He has told me he loved me. He cooks us dinner and he brings us dinner. And it's like when my mother passed away, it released something in him. I don't know what happened, and I don't have to understand what happened. But I love my daddy today, and I don't hate him anymore. There's no hate in my heart anymore, and Al-Anon has removed the hate in my heart and replaced it with love and acceptance. And it's then that I realized that, you know, after my kids reached a certain age, I stopped hugging them. And my daughter came in, my youngest daughter, and I said, can we try something? And she said, what? And I put my arms around her, and I said, how does this feel? She said, it doesn't feel good. It's uncomfortable. And I said, it don't feel good to me either. It's uncomfortable. But can we just stand here until it feels right? Until it feels right. Because by then I knew how this disease had affected me. So we stood there until it felt right, and it still feels right today. It feels right. I can never give back to this program what it's given back to me, and I am so grateful for those people when the light was so dark. They leaned over, and they lit my candle, and they led me out of that dark despair. I'm so incredibly grateful that I don't live at the address that I used to live at. Today I reside at a different address, and I'm grateful. And I would like to read a reading, and then I'm going to close. It's from our 12 and 12. It's the epilogue, and it's one of my favorite readings. It says, I look back on my troubled life before Al-Anon, when I felt as though I were grouping around in the terrifying black cave. There was no way out. No matter how desperately I prayed and struggled, I was trapped. There was no way out of the hopeless confusion of my life. Suddenly, someone, a stranger, took me by the hand and led me around the turn in the cave that opened up into a tunnel dotted by a row of lights. She led me as far as the first light and said, just keep following the lights and you'll be all right. I didn't care where they led, just as long as I could get out of the black despair I was living in. As I walked from one light to the next, the path through the tunnel became more and more bright, and my fears gradually faded. Finally, there came the brightest light of all, sunshine and freedom. The lights were our 12 steps and our 12 traditions, which kept showing me the way out of my confusion. With them, I felt holy and secure. I knew there would be many others like me who couldn't find their way to that tunnel of lights with the lamps of hope. Remembering my own pain, I tried to start many others to that ultimate sunshine we find in our beautiful program of Al-Anon. And because of Al-Anon, and because of all of you, I've got something to give to others today, and I am that person that walks across the room and helps light somebody's way out of that darkness of despair. Thank you.